Ragtime to Rock and Roll. In the 12th program in the series, Kenneth Moore describes the heyday of the big band era created by Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, the Dorseys, and many others. While in Britain, the reigning monarch inadvertently helped the song to become a bestseller. How Diana Durbin vied with Shirley Temple for box office honors, and how a comedian called Bob Hope became a famous singer.
One of the most striking things about following the trail of popular music in this century is the way that people drift from one environment to another in search of their favourite song or their favourite singer. At the turn of the century, they were flocking to the music hall or to the theatre, depending on the size of their wallets. But after the Great War, they began sitting round gramophones or wirelesses. And 1936 marks the point where they began congregating in a new spot, the local dance hall. The second half of the 1930s was the great age of the touring dance orchestra, the big band era as it's since come to be known. And it wasn't long before the whole world could identify their favourite orchestras by their signature tunes and their hit records. Sometimes those hit records were a complete fluke, as Bob Crosby admits.
We wrote most of the things we recorded. We did have accidental hits, like Big Noise from Winnetka. It was a complete accident. Came about from a bunch of kids coming in the Black Hawk restaurant who lived in a little suburb of Chicago called Winnetka, and making so much noise for encores that in desperation after we'd played everything in the book one night, I said to Ray Baduke and Bobby Haggard, play a bass and drum duet. And they just started to play the blues, and Haggard started that silly whistle, which no one has ever been able to copy since because he had a cleavage right here in his front teeth. It was a fun thing for us. And we did go into a recording session, minus one arrangement that we weren't happy with. And we told Cap we're going to do this bass and drum duet. And we wound up with probably one of the biggest hits ever recorded in the jazz field. I would say over the years that Big Noise Winnetka must have sold it well into the millions, probably 10 or 14 million copies. Nothing but a bass and drum and a silly whistle.
Nothing but a bass and drum and a silly whistle, as Bob Crosby says. But it wasn't always as straightforward as that. Some of the bands, especially the authentic jazz orchestras, rather than the dance bands, had trouble getting the public to support them. The dividing line between jazz and dance music was so blurred in the later 1930s that not even the musicians could always tell the difference. And Jimmy Rushing, the 21 Stone singer with the Count Basie Orchestra, describes what a touch-and-go business popularity could be.
Went to New York, and we played. We had a lot of trouble in the band as far as trying to please the people. And because our band was mostly on the blues kick, and at that time, people didn't know too much about blues, but they would nod their head. And As long as they was bowing their head and keeping up with the music, we were satisfied. They were keeping up with the beat. We were working at the Roseland Ballroom, and incidentally, Woody Herman was working on the next bandstand next to us, and he had just left Isom Jones, and he had just organized his combo. So he used to come over in our band and say, Basie, what is that you play that has such a terrific beat? Basie said, oh, that's just the blues.
Clock Jump, the identifying sound of the pre-war Count Basie band, or the signature tune, as it was called. Some of these signature tunes sold millions and millions of copies. Remember this one? Dorsey. He used to be billed as the sentimental gentleman of swing, although rumor has it that he was about as sentimental as a combine harvester. Now, bands like Dorsey's toured America, while others stayed home and became so identified with one particular ballroom that they actually wrote songs about it. In Harlem, there was a drummer called Chick Webb, who worked at a place called the Savoy Ballroom, wrote a song about it called Stomping at the Savoy, and also discovered Ella Fitzgerald.
It was a very ambitious band because we had a very ambitious leader who believed that you could do anything. He never felt like he was the only star. Anyone who could do something, he gave them a chance to do it. Like he used to tell me, never want to be something that goes up fast because you come down. You can come down the same way and you meet the same people coming down as you do going up. And I always remember those things because I felt that, I wanted to be a big success in a hurry, but I learned and I found it all through the years that you never appreciate anything if you get it in a hurry. Reminiscence by the drummer Buddy Rich features the most legendary band leader of the lot.
I started listening about 1936, 1937 to Benny Goodman, which kind of changed the direction of my musical taste. Didn't change the taste exactly, but there were different trends that were happening with Goodman. The sound of the band, the way he played, the excitement of the band. Krupa's great playing, Jeff Stacy's great work on piano, and Lionel Hampton in the band.
I suppose those days were the best that the progressional jazz musician ever knew, in the sense that for one brief interlude, his music was genuinely commercial. For instance, in the summer of 1937, renowned jazz trumpeter, having formed his own touring band, a hopeful group rather than a successful one, makes one record and instantly goes into the social history books. The trumpeter was Bunny Bedigan, and he got so excited about it that he even started singing as well as playing the trumpet.
I've flown around the world in a plane. I've settled revolutions in Spain. And the North Pole I have charted. Still I can't get started with you. On the golf course, I'm under par. Metro Goldwyn have asked me to star. I've got a house, a show place. Still I can't get no place with you. Cause you're so supreme. Lyrics I write of you, I dream. Dream day and night of you. And I scheme just for the sight of you. Baby, what good does it do? I've been consulted by Franklin D. Greta Garbo has had me to tea. Still I'm broken hearted, cause I can't get started with you.
Bunny Bedigan, I Can't Get Started. The record that actually did get him started, although his death from pneumonia not long after ended a very promising career. In Britain, too, the dance band surged to a popularity they'd never known before. And if it wasn't quite on the scale of the famous American outfits, they were still in a pretty impressive way of business. One of the most successful was a Californian expatriate called Roy Fox, who came across his great heartthrob singer in the most casual way.
One night I was asked to go out, the Ace of Spades. And, you know, I found some of my boys there, Jack Nathan and Ivor Mayrance and Morris Berman and Les Lambert. They're all in the band, so they came with me. And then so I said, well, now we need a vocalist. So Lou and Bill said, we know the very person. I said, well, who's that? They said, well, his name is Al Bowley. And I said, well, who's he with? They said, well, he's not with anyone. He's been having a difficult time. He's been singing. He's been busking in queues outside the theaters. And I said, well, he can't be a very good vocalist if he's busking outside of queues, you know, for sixpences. And anyway, they talked me into hearing this boy. And so he came in, and he was sort of a swarthy-looking boy. He was nicely dressed and made a very nice appearance, very polite, and had a nice personality. So I said, all right, well, let's hear you sing something. So Lou accompanied him at the piano, and the moment he opened his mouth, I knew that this is a boy I would like to have.
Good night, Vienna. New city of a million melodies. Our hearts are thrilling to the strains that you play from dawn till the day I die. Good night, Vienna, where moonlight fills the air with mysteries, and eyes are shining through the gypsy guitars that sing to the starry skies. Enchanted city of Columbine and Pierrot, we know the magic of your spell. Of our romances, you're the hero. Now is the time to say farewell. Good night, Vienna. Now live a kiss beneath your linden trees. The world is waiting on the edge of the day, just waiting to say good night.
That is how Al Boley sounded when band leader Roy Fox discovered him in the early 1930s. By the end of the decade, Boley was the greatest vocal heartthrob in Britain. One of the great differences between the kind of orchestras that Boley worked with and their American counterparts was that in Britain, a great many of the highest paid groups inadvertently symbolized a sort of social contrast that's reflected in the name they were sometimes given, society bands. Which society? Well, the very highest society, the highest in the land. While the mass of the British people struggled to keep in a job and picked up their acquaintance with the famous band leaders through the wireless, the cream of British society actually hired them to play for private functions. And there was no telling where you might end up if you really did take the aristocratic fancy, as Bert Ambrose did. Perhaps he was the only leader who could boast a drummer that turned down a throne.
On one occasion at Mrs. Vanderbilt's, I remember that was the Carlton House Terrace, there was a dance there, and we had what it was termed the most expensive band in the world. We were playing, and then we had the Duke of Windsor as Prince of Wales. He always played the drums. We had the Duke of Connaught with bad leg. He played the piano, and King Alfonso played the bass. And I scratched on the fiddle as usual. Singing one of Cole Porter's greatest songs with the Ambrose Orchestra. Now, life in that kind of band was comfortable enough, economically speaking, but sometimes the musicians might get a little bored with the routine, especially if they were jazz inclined. Then they might go off and play what they wanted in their own spare time, or make records under their own name, or even in time graduate to becoming band leaders themselves, which is what happened to Lou Stone's star trumpeter Nat Ganilla, who remembers how primitive the old recording methods were.
That sort of big wax was probably about inch and a half, 2 inches thick, and this this sort of needle went onto this wax and made grooves as it went round and round, and recorded your music. And I used to play my trumpet very often 30 or 40 yards away from the microphone, because they were afraid if you blew too loud, you'd make a big hole into the wax, and of course the record would come out most horrible, I suppose.
One of his most successful numbers. One funny thing about jazzmen like Canella, the thing that's always overlooked, is that they had no repertoire of their own. At least, not in the sense that a ballet dancer can lean on Tchaikovsky or Chopin, and the opera singer learns to rely on Wagner or Puccini. The jazz musician had to borrow his raw material from the musical theatre, but fortunately for him, this was an unusually rich period, when the songwriters of commercial musicals were constantly coming up with suitable themes. In 1937, for instance, Rodgers and Hart wrote a show called Babes in Arms, one of those stories about precocious kids who keep saying to each other, "Hey, why don't we put on a show of our own?" Babes in Arms were so packed with hits that it's hard to know where to begin. The artist who became most closely associated with one of those hits wasn't in the show, but it was her version of the song that remained the definitive version for a good many years. The song, The Lady is a Tramp, the singer, Sophie Tucker.
She's wined and dined on Mulligan's stool, and never wished for turkey. She's hitched and hiked and gripped it too, from Maine to Albuquerque. Alas, she missed the Beaux-Arts ball, and what is twice as sad, she was never at a party where they honored Noel Cass. Society, she says, is much too fast. Preferring her bohemia, first and last. She gets too hungry for dinner at eight. She likes the theater, but never comes late. She never bothers with people she hates. That's why the lady is a tramp. She don't like crap games with barons and earls. Won't go to Harlem in ermine and fur. Won't dish the dirt with the rest of the girls. That's why the lady is a tramp. She likes the free, fresh wind in her hair. Life without care. She broke its oath, hates California, 'cause it's cold and it's damp. That's why the lady is a tramp.
Rogers was so busy turning out music in the late 1930s that you begin to wonder when he got time to sleep. In 1937, the same season as Babes in Arms, Rogers tackled a project absolutely unheard of before in the realm of Broadway musicals, a show about performers who didn't do Broadway musicals. Richard Rogers explains.
On Your Toes was the first use of ballet as part of the play in a musical comedy. There had been ballets in revues, but these were sort of Arabian Nights ballets, and they were interpolations. And there being reviews, there was no story. But in the case of On Your Toes, the show was about a boy who became a ballet dancer from being a school teacher. So the ballet became an integral part of the play itself. And Balanchine did the choreography, and Zorina danced in it, and Ray Bolger. And none of this had ever been done before. And it was a big, big step forward in musical theater.
Slaughter on 10th Avenue, conducted by the composer, the prolific Richard Rogers. Meanwhile, what was happening out on the West Coast? Well, practically everything, it seems. A young singer called Alan Jones suddenly found himself plunged into the madhouse of a Marx Brothers movie. As a matter of fact, it was such a madhouse that poor Jones nearly had his big number cut out of the film altogether. The story begins when the songwriters Arthur Freed and Nacio Herb Brown are asked by producer Irving Thalberg to write a song for Jones. Alan Jones now takes over.
And they said, we've had this song for years, and we just thought of it and picked it out of the trunk. So I went over to Irving Thalberg's office, and I sang it for him, and he liked it, and he put it in the picture. So Thalberg had a brilliant idea of sending us out on the road to play motion picture houses where they had variety shows, four shows a day. When we got back, ready to make the picture, Arthur Freed called me and he said, "Hey," said, "the Marx Brothers had that song Alone cut out of the picture." And I said, "Well, I didn't know about it." So I went over to see Irving Thalberg. I said, "Irving, I understand that Marx Brothers don't like Alone and they've cut it out." He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, Irving, I don't presume to be a prophet or anything about songs, but," he said, "I think it's a big mistake. This song is a beautiful song." He said, "Well, the Marx Brothers know their comedy, and you should know your music, so we'll put it back in." And they did. And it was number one on the Lucky Strike Hit Parade for 17 consecutive weeks.
A million stars are shining bright that glorify the sky. A million lovers are...
Alan Jones, who was finally permitted by the Marx Brothers to sing that song in that comic masterpiece, The Night at the Opera. The next singer to work with the four brothers was an ex-saxophone player called Tony Martin, and what he didn't know when he walked into the wonderland of Groucho and Company was that this movie, The Big Store, was going to give him the biggest hit of his whole life.
It was a great piece of music, because at that time it was during the time of the Hitler problem, and it was way ahead of the times. It was about the Colemans and the Kellys, the Campers, the Vermicellis. It was a message about how people should get together.
Schubert wrote a symphony. Too bad he didn't finish it. Gershwin took a chord in G and proceeded to diminish it. I sought a variation on a theme that I thought pretty, and I found my inspiration on the east side of New York City. My tenement symphony, the Cohens, the Anora, the Campbells and their Victrola, all warm the heart of my tenement symphony. Come tumbling down the stairs, doodly-ah, doodly-ah, doodly-ah.
Tenement Symphony, and the voice of Tony Martin, one of the tiny group of straight men who had somehow to keep themselves from laughing while singing the romantic ballads in the Marx Brothers pictures. The irony was that the most original of all the singers who appeared in the Marx Brothers movies was Groucho Marx himself, who throughout his life had been making a vocal career out of sheer unadulterated lechery.
Lydia, oh Lydia, say, have you met Lydia? Lydia, the tattooed lady. She has eyes that folks adore so, and a torso even more so. Lydia, oh Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh Lydia, the queen of tattoo. On her back is the Battle of Waterloo. Beside it, the wreck of the Hesperus too. And proudly above waves the red, white, and blue. You can learn a lot from Lydia. When a robe is unfurled, she will show you the world. If you step up and tell her where. For a dime you can see Kankakee or Paris. Or Washington crossing the Delaware. So start relaxing. Up the hill comes Andrew Jackson. Lydia, oh Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh Lydia, the queen of them all. For 2 bits she will do a mazurka in jazz. With a view of Niagara that nobody has. And on a clear day you can see Alcatraz. You can learn a lot from Lydia. Over on the west coast, we have Treasure Island. Is Nijinsky a-doing the rumba? Is her social security number? Oh, Lydia, oh, Lydia, that encyclopedia. Oh, Lydia, the champ of the world. She once swept an admiral clear off his feet. The ships on her hips made his heart skip a beat. And now the old boy's in command of the fleet. For he went and married Lydia. I said Lydia.
He said Lydia.
They said Lydia.
We said Lydia.
La, la.
Groucho Marx still surveying the local scenery in his own especial way. By 1937, when that tribute to the art of acupuncture was written, the Marx Brothers and Hollywood generally were at their peak. All the major studios were pouring out hundreds of feature films. Mr. Louis B. Mayer, president of MGM, was reputed to be earning more money than Franklin D. Roosevelt. And some of the film stars were reputedly earning more than Louis B. Mayer. Thousands of talented people poured into the movie colony. And if anything, the major studios were overstaffed. Among the overstaff was a musician, Gordon Jenkins.
At Paramount, there were 27 people in the music department, and 3 of us could do anything. Victor Young, and myself, and Irving Talbot. I'm sure his name is not known. Very efficient conductor. And scorer, we'd write him, and he'd score him, match the pictures. Excellent. And, period. Nobody else could do anything. But they were in there because they were either related to Boris Morris, who was the head of it, or he owed him a favor, he owed somebody else a favor. And that was it. 3 out of 27. I mean, musicians that you can count on to deliver something for you, not, you know, just fake your way through.
Well, let's see how right Gordon Jenkins was and find out how that vast staff at Paramount didn't just fake through. The year is 1937. Paramount's big moneymaker is the girl in the sarong, Dorothy L'Amour. But now the studio is just about to stumble on an even bigger box office draw. One of the men who had something to do with it was one of the legions in the Paramount Music Department, Leo Robin.
This director came to us and said, "Boys, you've got to help me out." He said, "I'm stuck. I've got a scene in this picture. There are two sophisticated people who had been married and divorced. But by chance, they meet on an ocean liner, and they're sitting in the bar of this ocean liner. And he says, I've got to say that they're still in love, but they dare not say it to one another. Now, he said, I've had a half a dozen writers try to write this scene in dialogue, and it doesn't work. Now, he said, last night, he says, I couldn't sleep, and I got a brainstorm. I said to myself, if I could do this scene in words and music, maybe it would play. He said, remember, the fellow in the picture is a man that we just brought on from New York. He's a comedian. And this song has got to have some laughs in it. Ralph said, look, this is a scene. You better write the lyrics first. Ordinarily, he wrote the melody first. This took a long time to write. I spent more time on this song than any other I've ever written. I came in with these lyrics, and Ralph set that wonderful melody that he wrote.
Thanks for the memory of sentimental verse. Nothing in my purse, and chuckles when the preacher said, for better or for worse.
How lovely it was. For the memory of Schubert's serenade, little things of jade, and traffic jams and anagrams and bills we never paid.
How lovely it was. We who could laugh over big things were parted by only a slight thing.
I wonder if we did the right thing. Oh, well, that's life, I guess.
I love your dress.
Do you?
It's pretty.
Thanks for the memory of faults that you forgave, rainbows on a wave,
and stockings in the basin when a fellow needs a shave. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the memory of tinkling temple bells, alma mater yells,
and Cuban rum and towels from the very best hotels.
Oh, how lovely it was. Thanks for the memory of cushions on the floor, hashed with Vinnie Moore, that pair of gay pajamas that you bought and never wore.
Say, by the way, whatever became of those pajamas?
Huh?
Huh?
We said goodbye with a highball.